Thanks for tuning in. From Municipal World, I'm Susan Gardner. This is the MW Shares podcast, where we share your stories, providing insights into the challenges and opportunities facing local governments and communities just like yours. Thanks for joining us for another episode of MW Shares. Our guest today is Ian McCormick. In this episode, we're looking at behaviors that sometimes get municipal leaders in hot water and some approaches that might serve them better as they pursue their community's goals. Ian is the president of Strategic Steps. He describes himself as living in the space between appointed and elected officials and municipal managers. He's also the author of a new book just published by Municipal World, Who's Driving the Greater and Other Governance Questions. Welcome, Ian.
Thanks very much, Susan. I'm quite looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. Now, over the past couple of decades, you've had the opportunity to work with a lot of municipalities on governance and structural reviews, strategy development, orientations. So there's a lot of takeaways in your book that come out of those experiences.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, I've worked not only with municipalities in this type of context of providing some advisory services to them, but I also spent some time working out of the Deputy Minister's office in the provincial government and under municipal affairs in Alberta. So I got to see a little bit of how local governments operate from the other side as well. And that was quite the eye-opener. And in fact, some of the comments in the book derive from that experience as well.
So one of the things that I really enjoy about this book is the chapter titles. And a lot of those come out of some tips and advice, short, pithy sayings that you've kind of dispersed as advice to municipalities that you've worked with over the years.
So that's quite true. And the book, of course, is divided into two parts. The first one is those short, pithy titles. And those came about either because of statements that I would frequently provide while working on assignments or providing strategic planning or council orientations. And they were things that I would say over and over again. And one of my associates started calling them Ianisms, and she kept track of them. And so they eventually became chapter headings here. And it makes me look good too, because there's a lot of chapters in the book, although the chapters, of course, are relatively short. And they stand alone pretty well as well. So yes, they are sayings that either I developed or where I overheard other people use and then adopted for my own use as well. So there are some places in here where I credited some other people with actually coming up with these titles. And I really appreciate what other people have been able to provide us to this as well.
So they're, as we said, pithy and kind of lighthearted, but the subject matter is serious. So it's kind of a nice way to ease into some of these serious topics that municipalities need to be aware of, need to deal with in their communities as they go about meeting their governance challenges.
So you're right, and I think a lot of it, the core function of this, of course, is all about whatever the good governance means to different people. And of course, there's no Bible of good governance or a real list of what the principles of good governance are, although there does seem to be some common agreement in some of these areas. So the one thing that draws all the chapters together is looking at a real practical experience that we've developed over the years and how good governance looks, how it appears, how it's actually conducted from time to time by either those elected officials referred to earlier or senior managers. And I think I even referenced the guy who cuts the grass as well as one of the places in the book where good governance comes to bear. Particularly in the first part, we talk about good governance associated with some of these chapter titles that we just kind of learned over the years about things like no strategy survives first contact with reality, or even who's driving the greater, which is of course the subject or the title of the book. And the title of the book has actually been something that has gotten a few smiles from those people who understand the role of elected and appointed officials and who's supposed to be doing which job and where the line between governance and management and administration lies. So those people who are involved in the municipal realm get a bit of a chuckle about who's driving the greater.
It is a little bit of an inside joke, because it's a question that may from time to time come up with those who are new to governing.
Absolutely true. And even those who've been in it for a long time, culture comes to play in all of this as well.
So one of the chapters that we're going to be talking about today is Stop Doing Stupid Stuff. It's kind of a provocative title by design. As I said, it's going to form the basis for what we're talking about. Where did that title come from?
So you talk about it being a little provocative, and of course it is. The flip side, of course, is to start doing smart stuff. What it came from was, there's an adage too that shows up in the book about when you're digging yourself a hole, the best thing you can do is stop digging. And it's talking about, there's a reason that local governments do the things they do, whether that's a service or program they offer or an amenity or a facility that's available. And while it's not stupid stuff, what we do see from time to time is a lack of oversight, historical oversight into why things are the way they are today. So for example, there may be a reason that the local government decided to offer a program back in the 1950s or the 1980s. And we need to examine that from time to time to make sure that what it was demanded at that time is still relevant to this time. And that's particularly true in a time right now where resources, as always, are scarce. And those resources can be money or people or time or political capital. So in order to free up those sorts of resources, we have to stop doing things which may have been demanded sometime in the past. So it is a bit of a provocative title, but I hope it gets people thinking a little too.
I hope so. Let's talk about what you feel might be, as you said, you know, it's important to always, be looking at, the foundation for things, the reason that they're done. Are they still required to be done? Are there some common patterns or pitfalls, things that continue to get municipalities inadvertently in trouble, either with the public, their partners, other municipalities, their staff?
Right. Well, there are always several versions of the truth on things which may become somewhat contentious. And municipalities can get themselves in trouble, I think, if they're not actually paying attention to those things. And I stick as much as possible to governance in this, even though those fellows who gather at the coffee shop on the corner are quite likely to comment on grass cutting and snow clearing. We talk a little bit about that, but we concentrate more on strategy. So if we look at it from a governance perspective in terms of strategy, we start with things like strategic plans or bylaws or policies, the sorts of things that really provide high-level long-term direction for local government. So first of all, the absence of those, particularly a strategic plan which drives focus, really tells us that a municipality might be trying to be all things to all people, or is taking a bit of a scattergun approach and just attacking whatever is the next shiny object. And things like strat plans can certainly be used, if developed by council, to focus that very self-same council if they do come up with something that's a bit shiny. Other examples are things like, and I reference it several times, but policy. So we develop policy essentially in local government. So council tells administration what the decision is going to be on whatever the topic happens to be. And then we don't have to come back and ask council every time how tall the grass should be cut. So if those things aren't re-examined, then the municipality runs the risk of just doing things the way we have always done them for the sake of having done them that way. The other thing we find is, particularly in times before the digital age, there are lots of policies on the books of local governments which really aren't relevant anymore. May have been relevant in the early 1900s up to the 1970s and 80s when things started to become digital, which don't get reviewed but are still official policy within a community, and that can start to get people into trouble too. In as much of the contents of the policy, but also in the lack of review of those policies. If we find that there's a reference in the book here too to a policy we ran across once about the community had a horse hitching policy on Main Street, which is not something that is going to do anybody any harm, but it's probably not something that they need anymore, particularly since I suspect the hitching posts are gone. But what that tells us is perhaps they haven't reviewed their policies in an awfully long time. So what's gathering dust in those dusty old binders in the vault in the back room, if not reviewed, makes me wonder what else is there that hasn't been reviewed. Is there an opportunity there to clean out some of the dusty stuff, take some of those old policies off the books, and perhaps re-examine policies that may not have been looked at for many, many years. Streamline, get rid of red tape, all those kind of things that we hear about from time to time, and looking at effective local government.
So often, you know, we see in, especially more recent years, we see some provincial legislation that builds in things for sunset clauses so that these things do happen, you know, on a more regular basis. If you're a municipality that's, you know, got a large number of these bylaws and policies on the books, how often should you be doing that review?
The short answer is it depends. But I think for those things that are governance-related policy, the things that councils will be in charge of, I would suggest that at least they get eyes on them once a term. Some will require more than that, of course. They may need to be looked at every year. And some may need to be updated based on changes to provincial legislation. So employment legislation or safe workplace legislation may require policy to be updated more often. But if a council looks at its governance policies once every 4 years, now that that's the term in almost all of Canada, at least we have an idea that council has a pretty good understanding of what its job is. More so even for those people who may be continuing on into future terms than those whose terms may be expiring or those people who may get democratically retired in the next election. But at least putting eyes on bylaws and policies gives an idea of what is still relevant and helps the elected officials understand what it is that municipalities actually do. It also puts a bit of onus on administrations too to kind of keep an eye on those things so that there may be policies that have been on the books for many decades that when they come before council, there may be a recommendation in a request for decision report that perhaps this policy is no longer required. So generally I'd say 4 years given the legislative term, some things would happen more often, and I suppose the corollary is some things would happen less often as well. More so for policies than I would say for bylaws.
Now we're going to take a short break before getting into the rest of the conversation with Ian McCormick. It's time to pull back the curtain on local government. In his new book, Who's Driving the Greater and Other Governance Questions, Ian McCormick aims to separate the wheat from the chaff. He offers today's leaders a course correction from an uninspired abyss. Drawing from real-life encounters in local government, McCormick puts a passionate and humorous spin on the modern issues facing municipalities. With a foreword by local government legend George Cuff, this book offers a valuable shock of insight and nuance for local leaders everywhere. Order your copy of Who's Driving the Greater at books.municipalworld.com. Without further delay, let's jump back into that conversation with Ian McCormick. You referenced earlier when we were talking about, you know, the question about who's driving the greater. You referenced the role of culture and history. What role does culture and history have in, you know, taking this kind of proactive approach and adapting to the future as the world evolves?
Mm-hmm. When we look at statute, whether it's bylaw or policy or act, those are really, in many ways, a skeleton. What puts the meat on the bones, I think, frequently is history and culture within a particular municipality. We find that every municipality is unique in one way or another. Some are fairly similar and some are vastly different, but they all operate under fundamentally the same laws of the land, and in many cases, very similar bylaws and policies too. So culture, I think, really defines the sense of place. It becomes, for those people who've grown up in it, it is the water that they swim in and they don't even notice it anymore. For those people who are new to town, perhaps they do notice it, but again, they warm up to that water as well and it becomes what they swim in. When people like me and colleagues end up working in municipalities, for better or for worse, we'll often see that there's a slight difference in the way legislation is interpreted where there is space for interpretation. And so that culture, sense of history, I think is really colorful. We don't want a whole series of thousands of municipalities across the country who are essentially cookie cutters of each other. Even if you look in provinces where there are several hundred municipalities of various types and sizes, we don't want them all to be the same too. So culture, I think, is really important. An aspect of culture, though, that can prove problematic sometimes is the application of what they would call, what the people in the community would call best practice. We've done these things the way we've done them, and they seem to work for us. So we just essentially look inwards a lot of times for what is best practice. I think looking outwards for best practice is a really good way to go. What are other municipalities of similar sizes, with similar economic structures, similar histories doing, and how are they doing things better than us? And conversely, are there practices that we could lend to them as well? And in many cases, that crosses provincial or territorial borders quite easily. And I think there's a real danger in looking inward for best practice. Oftentimes, it's not there. Sometimes it is, but I think for the most part, if there's a sense of looking for a place to improve, look to your neighbors.
It is true that just kind of having that myopic focus leads to a best practice that equals the way we've always done it.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if you're going to get to this later or not, but I had a colleague who now teaches at the University of Victoria who taught me about a concept called wise practice, which she defined as best practice modified for local circumstance. So what may be a good practice in a really large metropolitan center may not be a best practice in a small rural village, but there may be some kernels to it which may apply. So adapting what works from this big city to the small town in terms of principle could still apply, but adapting what is best practice in the major city to a smaller community may not apply until you adapt it.
That's a great point. It's something that we've always kind of encouraged through municipal world, through the magazine and, the case studies that we share. The value of this, I think, is, looking at these practices from other places and as you said, not trying to apply them wholesale to your unique situation, but looking at them critically and saying, what value, what is there that would be valuable for our community? What could we learn from that? What could make our practices better? So that's a great point.
I think I do see that. And I also see that I recognize too that there's limited capacity in most municipalities, that they're doing the best they can with what they've got at the time. So expending the extra effort to go looking at what's happening elsewhere and trying to adapt it locally does take effort at the start of the process, but the anticipation would be that it would provide some return later on. So when you mention publishing case studies and whatnot, to me, that's a really good way of doing some of the legwork for some of these communities that may not know that they ought to be looking elsewhere, or just may not have the ability amongst other things they have to be doing for this to reach high enough up their priority list to be able to provide the value that they need to see out of it.
Absolutely. And I think it's, really a credit to municipalities who very proactively and freely share their lessons learned. And we know that often there are tough lessons learned in there, but being very transparent and open and sharing about it so that, others can see the process, can see the outcomes and take away what might be of value to them.
Yeah, I see that in places also with professional associations, whether that's FCM or a provincial municipal association or provincial or territorial associations of city managers or municipal clerks, that those are really places I think some of that cross-pollination can start to happen. And one of the real benefits of getting together, which has been, of course, impeded in some ways by COVID, but has also been accelerated by COVID a little bit because travel costs now are so much lower than they have been in the past, which has removed one of the major barriers, I think, to participation in some of these things.
Absolutely. Now, when you talk about some of these fiscal realities that we know are challenges for many communities, many communities are working to become sustainable, of course, means a lot of things, but one of those pillars is economics. And what are some ways you think councils can encourage economic sustainability?
I often hear that councils are interested in things like economic development or diversifying the economy. And there are limited things that a council itself can do. And fundamentally, to me anyway, when I think about this type of a thing, I think the municipal role or council's role is to do one of two things. It can either do something or it can get out of the way as other people do something. So if we take that apart a little bit, I see one of the roles of council in perhaps becoming a little bit more risk tolerant than they currently are. They often speak about wanting to be innovative or to be an employer of choice or to attract a particular type of business. And to do that, they need to innovate. But in order to innovate, if you look at the flip side of that coin, is risk. So councils need to, elected officials need to be a little bit more tolerant, I think, of prudent risk. But there's also a recognition that risk by definition means that there is a chance whatever they try isn't going to work. And they need to be tolerant of that as long as it's done prudently. So there are things that a municipality can do. It can work with its local organizations like chambers of commerce, post-secondary education facilities or institutions that might be there. It can also do things like create business incubators, if it likes, short-term business incubators, or partner with other organizations to do something like that. So this is one of those cases where government might actually be doing something. And we hear quite a lot at the moment about reducing red tape. And sometimes a little bit of red tape is actually necessary to provide some of that innovation that that we're looking for of the long term. So, I mean, those are some of the things I think can do in terms of economic development. I've seen more and more municipalities now looking at regional economic development, or the rising tide floats all boats. And there's a bit of a two sides to that one as well, because if a municipality is partnering in a regional economic development initiative, chances are the local government still wants all the economic inputs to come into my municipality, rather than just necessarily attracting them to the region per se. So I mean, economics is a driver. I hear a debate going on at the moment about the supporting the economy or supporting people. And it comes down to a bit, to me anyway, to a little bit of a definition of what is the role of the people who are working in whatever the economy is doing in a particular region. Is the economy there to support the people, or are the people there to support the economy? And if there were no people, of course, there'd be no need for government. But if the people are there to support the economy, then that makes local government make some different choices than if we see people there to support the economy and therefore the people are an input, like raw material or cash or those sorts of things. So to me, there's a perspective that needs to be closely examined as you look at what happens locally in terms of regional supporting the local economies.
A tricky question, tricky balance to achieve there. One of the most important responsibilities for a council is around the hiring and collaboration, working with a CAO. And this is something, you know, it's an area we see at various times, a lot of turnover, a lot of discussion around that relationship. What sort of goals should be in a CAO's contract?
Well, first of all, it's very important the CAO has a contract. And in terms of goals, we'd be looking at things like annual performance. So the one I almost always recommend is that progress on council's strategic plan ought to be one of the goals of the CAO. There was one of the chapters, it's called, or one of the quotes I use in the book is saying, "What interests the minister fascinates me." And it was from a deputy minister I worked for. And what he was suggesting was, what is of interest to my boss certainly does fascinate me. And it should be the same, of course, with local government too. What interests council should fascinate the CAO, what interests the CAO should fascinate the directors and on down the line. Of course, that's only a one-way street, and that's where that person who cuts the grass comes in, because what interests that person doesn't necessarily fascinate council. Thanks. But you were talking about goals that are in the CAO's contract. To me, the prime one should be, is the work of the CAO advancing the strategic plan? Which means, of course, there's an assumption that there is a current strategic plan with measurable outcomes that's in it, which I think is really very important. I mean, there are other things that will necessarily fit into a CAO's contract too, looking downwards, safe and respectful workplaces, those sorts of things. But CAO contracts, to me, ought to be outcome-based rather than output-based. So it should be about making some change in that community over time. You also started this this point talking a little bit about CAOs who come and go. See a CAO leave a community in an involuntary fashion. As many times as not, it's because of fit rather than skill. Sometimes the council today will say, this is the last council's person, we need our own person, and out the current CAO goes. Or over time, if council is unable to achieve its goals, for whatever reason, out goes the CAO, because that's the only lever that councils have to pull. Although we have been in several situations where we have seen committees of council which oversee departments. So a public works committee of council or a recreation committee of council, which ostensibly is supervising the director in those cases. And that's just a recipe for disaster, because now the rec director has two accountabilities, one to council directly and one to the CAO. And that, of course, puts the CAO and the director in a very difficult spot. So we'll always advocate to make sure those lines of authority are clear, so that a director is not put in the position where they are responsible to numerous people and council gets out of the minutiae. I mean, that gets back to the title of the book about who's driving the greater. Does council really understand its role about governance versus administration? And whose job is it to try and manage upwards to tell council that they're getting a bit too far into the weeds? And the who's driving the greater came from a story in a rural municipality we worked with, where literally a member of council was complaining about how the gravel had been distributed along one of the rural roads, and said he could do the job better than the person who was actually doing it, and wanted to get out and literally drive the grader. So you asked the question starting about CAO goals, and I kind of morphed it into something completely different. But I think the primary thing is that CAOs do need to have contracts. They ought to have goals, which are outcomes, and the primary one in there should be advancing council's strategic plan.
And I think, you know, you referenced that the issue that we talked about at the outset, and it's kind of back to that issue of the extent to which culture and history can sometimes play, can play a positive role, certainly, but can sometimes play a detrimental role as well, in ways that negatively impact the ability of the CAO, the efficacy of the CAO to do their job and to manage their team to achieve those strategic goals for the municipality.
Yep, and the CAO, as the leader of the administrative team, is responsible for all those under him or her, and it's a tough spot for them to be put in as well. And that's when they end up potentially leaving either of their own volition or involuntarily.
Absolutely. Well, those are some great insights, and I don't want this conversation to end here, but it will be ending here for today. We're going to continue the conversation in the next episode. So I hope listeners will tune in then as we take a look at some of the foundational thinking that a municipality can and should embrace to help them do some of these things smarter.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you. I look forward to our next chat. I want to thank Ian McCormick for taking the time to chat with us, and thank you for listening. You can find Ian's book, Who's Driving the Greater, available now at books.municipalworld.com. We'd like to hear your ideas. If you have a topic you'd like to see covered in a future episode, simply drop us an email at stories@municipalworld.com. Also, don't forget to rate, comment, and subscribe. I'm Susan Gardner for Municipal World, and we'll be back with more stories next week.